Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Protests in Cuba spilling over into Boston. The music there and sound of a protest in Copley Square overnight, where activists rallied to support the thousands taking to the streets 1,500 miles away in Cuba. Massachusetts is home to a small but mighty Cuban population, the 13th largest in the country. And many stand in solidarity as family members and loved ones protest the lack of food and medical supplies on the island. WBUR's Simone Rios was at Copley Square and joins us now. Simone, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So, Simone, tell us what you heard from people at the protest.
So just to set the scene, there were a few dozen people across from Boston's Central Library. And there seemed to be a mix of perspectives, amid the Cuban flags and music that we heard. There was one guy with a Don't Tread on Me flag, which is used by the Tea Party movement. And another had a sign calling for an end to the U.S. embargo against Cuba, coming from a left position. I spoke to one of the organizers, Jordan Villalon. He's a grad student at La Salle University in Newton. He was born in Havana and raised in Miami.
No more fear. We have nothing else to lose at this current.
No tenemos miedo.
No tenemos miedo. We're not scared. We have been at this for 60 years. We have had the same problem for 60 plus years. And I think the goal is to end dictatorship and begin something new.
Another one of the organizers was Sam Bello. She's a Cuban-American and studies at a local college.
It doesn't matter how many decades I think people have been either here or wherever in the diaspora. I think most Cubans and Cuban-Americans can relate to what that is. It's in our everyday lives. It's in hearts. It's our trauma.
It's hard to say whether these kind of sentiments are consistent with what's happening on the island, Tiziana, but I think we can say that Cubans everywhere in the world are feeling this moment.
Simone, what do we know about the conditions that led to the protests in Cuba and here?
Cuba has had a very difficult time in recent years. I think regardless of your politics, people can agree that Cuba is suffering both economically and now because of the pandemic. The island with more doctors per capita than almost anywhere on Earth, the country that's developing its own COVID vaccines, but which can't secure basic medications or supplies like syringes. It's a tremendous irony. Here's what Jordan Villalon said he's hearing about the situation down there.
There's just no food. There's no water. If there was money, there would be nothing to buy. And it's hard to fathom. It sounds like an exaggeration. But before we get that far down the pipeline, we have to understand that right now what we're fighting for is basic human rights.
So politics come into play here when you ask, who's to blame for this situation? Is it the Cuban government or is it the six-decade U.S. embargo against Cuba?
Simone, you've been there. You've reported on the Cuban community here. Just how significant do you think it is to see such open dissent?
Yeah. So I was there in 2006. It was when Fidel Castro was stepping down and handing power over to his brother. So it might not have been a typical time on the island. But one of the things that stuck with me the most was there's many good things to say about Cuba, but what a closed society it was, a police state with really no room for freedom of expression. So, you know, I try to discuss politics with people in the street, and I quickly realized that they wouldn't say anything critical of the government in public and even hush their voices inside their homes. So to see people from what we're seeing here in the States taking to the streets in Cuba and calling for change in such a public way, you know, things we take for granted here in the U.S., That seems like a very big deal in Cuba. I spoke to Miren Uriarte. She's a former UMass Boston professor, born in Cuba, came to the U.S. a year after the 1959 revolution. She says she wants to see an end to the U.S. embargo against Cuba, which, of course, were hardened by the Trump administration, and which the Cuban government blames this uprising on. The question on the island, Uriarte says, is how the government will respond to these protests.
We need to see how the Cuban government approaches this, what kind of dialogue it establishes with the younger generation and with the people that are demonstrating, and what the outcome of that is.
Well, Simone, we will be watching for that outcome with you. WBUR reporter Simone Rios, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So listening into that report is Congressman Jim McGovern. He's just off a tour of three local hunger sites today. The congressman represents Massachusetts' 2nd District and chairs the House Rules Committee. He's also been active in U.S. policy toward Cuba throughout his time in public service. Congressman McGovern, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Happy to be with you.
I want to start with Cuba here. Cuba policy is important to you. You were there when President Obama traveled to Cuba the first time a sitting president had been to the island in nearly 90 years. So with all of that in mind, what is your reaction to what you've heard and are hearing from Cuban Americans in Massachusetts?
Well, first of all, all of our hearts are with the Cuban people. I strongly believe in the right for people to engage in peaceful and legitimate protest. I've called upon the Cuban government to respect the rights of their people to protest. Now, having said all of that, I think that one simple question should anchor U.S. policy on Cuba, and that is, how can we improve the lives of the people of Cuba? I think we have to recognize that U.S. policy for many decades has been focused on trying to overthrow the government and to economically starve the people. I mean, for anybody to not acknowledge that the U.S. embargo has had a major negative impact on the lives of average Cubans, anyone who says that it hasn't is not dealing with reality. One of the ways we can help Cuban people is we can lift the embargo. We can, and Biden can reverse Trump's added restrictions that he put into place when he was president, to make it easier for people to get food, syringes, other supplies, and to make it easier for people to travel to Cuba.
So with that in mind, the Cuban government is blaming these protests on the U.S., as well as the lack of supplies. President Miguel Diaz-Canel broke into national television to blame the U.S. for restricting exports, access and funds, tying those policies directly to the supply shortages. I hear you. I hear that. Any concern that putting the attention right now in the Biden administration, the embargoes, et cetera, gives cover to Miguel Diaz-Canel and policy decisions in Cuba?
Look, what I'm advocating is not about helping the Cuban government. It's about helping the Cuban people. President Trump put restrictions in place that do not even allow Cuban families the ability to send appropriate amounts of remittances back to their relatives in Cuba. Again, making it more difficult for average Cubans to be able to have a decent life. We should do what is right by the Cuban people. It should have nothing to do with what the Cuban government wants or doesn't want. People are protesting. They have legitimate reason to protest. Again, a poor response to the COVID pandemic, food shortages, people are hungry. People's civil liberties have been trampled on. So those are legitimate reasons for people to be upset. Any of us would protest that. But again, we have to recognize that U.S. policy has only contributed to making the lives of average Cubans more miserable. Not just recently, it's gone on for decades. And look, the Cuban government, the hardliners have been all too willing to blame us for everything. We give them fodder.
Let me break in here on this.
Advocating military action against Cuba. That's nuts.
So, Okay, so let me break in here on that. One more question on this, then I want to cover some hunger stuff with you too. But to that point, President Diaz-Canel is urging his supporters to take to the streets and physically confront protesters, deploying police and military against them. NPR estimates 148 people have been arrested, detained, or disappeared since Sunday. What should the U.S. response to that part be?
The U.S. response should be to engage the Cuban government, to tell them to stop. But since we don't have an ambassador in Cuba, I mean, we don't even have the diplomatic channels to be able to communicate in a responsible and mature way. And the other thing is we should do what is right by the Cuban people. I mean, let us help get humanitarian aid to the island. Let us lift the Trump restrictions. Let us go back to the Obama policies, quite frankly, of engagement. I condemn any crackdown on legitimate protest. I mean, we all do. But let's not use the Cuban government as an excuse to not help the Cuban people. And again, those people who right now are calling for military action, are calling for further restrictions that will only hurt the average Cuban even more, I think that's cruel. We ought to recognize that our Cold War policies for the last several decades have been a miserable failure. We ought to have a different approach to Cuba. We ought to normalize relations. We ought to engage the country so we actually can talk to them face-to-face on issues like human rights. But we got to focus on how do we help the Cuban people.
All right. Thank you for that. I'm going to turn our attention now here home, where we're also, I want to talk about hunger. As I said, you spent the day at three federally funded meal sites in Spencer and Worcester with Project Bread, which is a nonprofit hunger organization. We've talked with you a lot about hunger, including recently. So why a tour today in the middle of July?
Well, because hunger amongst children actually gets worse during the summertime when school is out and sometimes, you know, history is any indication, kids go without and we see food insecurity rise. So we have these federally funded summer meals programs. We want to highlight them. We want more people to take advantage of them. I'm also doing this because I am pushing the Biden administration to do a White House conference on food, nutrition, health, and hunger. We need to solve this problem. And, you know, summer meals is part of it, but it's only a part of it. We need to look at everything. And not just nutrition programs. We need to look at decent wages for jobs, housing. We need to look at the medical connections to nutrition. I mean, a whole thing. We need a holistic view here. And so, today I was visiting programs, quite frankly, that a lot of parents rely on to help feed their kids when school is out. And so, I talked to a lot of the parents and the kids. They're grateful for these programs. We got to support them. We made rules more flexible during the pandemic. We got to keep that flexibility in place so that more people can take advantage of them. And so it was a good visit.
Let's pick that up. So the USDA did just extend some free meal programs for kids to September. There are a lot of federal pandemic measures that affect family hunger that will expire. Last week, we had Assistant Speaker Catherine Clark on. She said she wanted to make several pandemic measures focused on kids permanent. Are you looking for the same thing on hunger measures that have resulted from the pandemic? Do you want permanent? You want them made permanent?
I do. I really do. Food is not a luxury. It's a necessity. And whether we're talking about our children or our senior citizens or anybody in between, we got to make sure that people have enough to eat. And when it comes to kids, you know, we ought to be thinking about, you know, providing everybody in school a free breakfast and lunch. You know, if you're hungry in school, you can't learn. And that breakfast or lunch is every bit as important to that child's ability to learn as a textbook or a laptop. We need to be thinking out of the box. And, you know, yeah, waivers are important, but we ought to be able to, you know, we ought to make these things permanent, whether it's a child tax credit, whether it's the flexibility in the meals program, whatever, to be able to pick up a meal at whatever site is convenient for you, whatever. But we got to do better on this, and that's why I want this White House conference, because we need to connect the dots. We need a holistic approach. Again, it's not just about our children, although our children are 100% of our future, and they're the most important things in the world to us. But we got to solve this problem throughout this country. We should be ashamed that close to 40 million people are hungry.
So we're having a little bit of sound challenge. I know you're on the move. Last question before we let you go. as you talk, I can hear critics in my head saying, hey, the government can't be our long-term solution to feeding people. So what do you say to that counter response? And what's the package of jobs, education, other forms of prosperity that you want in place to address hunger as well?
Well, one is I want good jobs to pay good wages. You know, when people say to me, oh, the government can't solve all the problems, but yet those same people are content with providing SNAP benefits to subsidize low wages by big corporations. I mean, look, we need to make sure that work pays in this country. We need to make sure that people have access to child care. We need to make sure that people can afford their medical care. All those things are incredibly important. So, you know, if you want to put these programs out of business, if you want to put food banks out of business, we can do that if we pay a living wage with good benefits. And that ought to be our focus.
All right. That is Congressman Jim McGovern, who represents Massachusetts 2nd District, also chairs the House Rules Committee. Chairman McGovern, thanks for joining us.
All the best.